This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Shirley Bloomfield, CEO of NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NTCA Shirley Bloomfield next. Did you know the price of U.S. sugar for American households is about 5% lower than other developed countries? In the U.S., 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers produce sugar under some of the world's strictest safety, labor, and environmental standards. These hardworking Americans support 151,000 jobs across two dozen states, maintain a reliable domestic supply chain, and contribute over $23 billion to the economy. American sugar companies pay fair wages and offer good benefits to their workers, including union jobs vital to rural and urban communities. The sugar program is the safety net for sugar producers in the Farm Bill. It has strong bipartisan support in Congress and is designed to cost the taxpayer $0. The current sugar program provides flexibility to allow for a reliable supply throughout the year and to accommodate imported foreign sugar required under our trade commitments. Weakening the sugar program would lead to greater dependence on unreliable foreign suppliers, costing us American farmers, blue-collar jobs, and domestic food security for this essential ingredient. For more, visit the American Sugar Alliance at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Despite the efforts of government agencies, billions in taxpayer dollars, and hundreds of companies, there's still a digital divide in the nation. Those who have adequate broadband service and those who don't. Shirley Bloomfield, CEO of NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association, says with so much work underway, it's hard to identify the haves and have-nots in the nation.
I would say that mapping will never be perfect, but I will also say that the easiest thing for us to see as a country and for policymakers is who does not have broadband, and wisely so. All of these federal initiatives really prioritize those who are just unserved. That is kind of the easiest thing to spot, right? We know if there's infrastructure. We know if there's a provider. We know if they have an option for some type of service. So the fact that all of these programs are really geared towards taking care of that part of the problem first and then moving to those consumers who have what we would consider almost laughable broadband service next is probably a laudable way of going about it. But, you know, all you can do is continue to make sure that we're looking at data, that we're gathering the data, and that we're testing out in the fields to see what Americans are really getting.
History lesson. At one time when I bought my first computer, I had a 14.4 modem. And then I got a 28.8, and then, wow, I got rocket speed up to a 56. I remember what used to be fast toward internet is really not fast anymore. So the baseline question is, have we or can we identify what should be a minimum bandwidth for upload and download, and how many people hit that mark?
Yeah, that is a really, really good question, and I think it's a really important one. And one of the things I will share is we look at seeing what are consumers demanding? What are they using? And, you know, I look at things like video streaming volume is up 38%, you know, from a year and a half ago. I look at the fact that, you know, Ookla, the medium U.S. speeds, Ookla will tell you that it is 145 over 20 megabits. The point there is that people are demanding more. They are doing more. They are utilizing these networks. So I think it's being honest about the fact that if we are going to take all of this federal support, this historic moment in time to get the job done, the ability to do it right the first time in our mind is really important, which is why we look at it and say, if you're going to get federal support, you're going to take advantage of any of these programs that are coming out there now, speed should be 100 over 100, should be fast enough to meet not only the demand of today, but the demand of 3 to 5 years from now. And when people say that consumers aren't using upload speed, so it's not important to be synchronous, I would call bogus on that, because I think when we look at what consumers are doing, they are uploading. That is how we're able to do all of the Zoom capacity and the VPNs and the ability to do streaming and to be doing it simultaneously within a household or within a small business. So we are very, very pro-fiber, obviously, because we do think that it is the best technology. We think it is the wisest investment. We think it has the lowest operating cost in the long run, which is really important. But no matter what, whatever technology people use, 100 over 100 really should be the standard that we are building towards.
So lots of money has been pushed toward this digital divide. I wouldn't expect off the cuff in an interview to provide an exhaustive list, but can you name the number of agencies that are involved, and in any way are they coordinating together where dollars are being allocated and results of that taxpayer investment?
So you are right, Jeff. This is an incredibly historic moment in time in terms of not only the dollars, but certainly in terms of the players. So I would say, you know, off the top, the key agencies to take a look at are USDA, which has long been a lender in the broadband space. They're rural utility providers. That's kind of their background. They have a chunk of money, not crazy big. It's been about $2 billion a year. But there is, you know, so there's a pot there. Then you've got the Department of Commerce, which has an agency called NTIA that is going to get really the big chunk of money coming down in the next year, which is the $42.5 billion just for the infrastructure that will be coming down through the Commerce Department dispersed through the states. Then you've got the Treasury Department that got $10 billion, and they have been allocating a bucket of funding to states to, again, have the states allocate. And then you've had the FCC that has done some reverse auctions and some Rural Digital Opportunity Funds that have been putting some money into capitalizing broadband. Then I would say you've got the states. So one of the things we saw post-COVID was a lot of money went to the states through the American Recovery Act. A lot of states chose to use that money to support broadband grants and investment as well. So you've got a lot of players. And the thing that I would say is you've got not only at least at a minimum 4 federal agencies that are in the game, you also have states that are in the game. So having all of these states on top of the federal government makes it even more complicated than just trying to get the federal government to coordinate. I will say I do see an effort among the federal government to coordinate, but I think we've got to be honest about the fact that that's going to be very difficult in real time as agencies are running to put money out there, making sure that they are taking locations off that map as soon as that money has been designated by a different agency. So if Treasury makes a build in North Dakota, that USDA does not go ahead and allocate funding for the same location. Those are things that we're all going to be watching very, very closely as this money really starts to flow.
So the Department of Agriculture has the ReConnect program, and you testified about this in Washington not long ago. What's good about the ReConnect, and what did you tell the leaders?
I am very bullish about the ReConnect program, just to share with you, and in part because, honestly, USDA probably knows more about building networks in rural, low-density parts of our country than any other federal agency does. People don't tend to think of them as high-tech. They have been the bankers for the companies I represent for decades. So they really understand the challenges. They understand the communities. They understand, you know, what it means to serve the farms. And so we have been very, very supportive of funding going to the ReConnect program. The other thing that I think that USDA has done extraordinarily well, which we'd love to see continued as the Farm Bill goes forward, is they've really done a lot of verification. You know, when somebody says they want to use money from USDA to go build that network, they go out into the field and they say, is there broadband here? If so, what is the speed? What is the connections that we are getting? So they do a double verification before the money is spent. They're also bankers at heart. So they are very prudent about where they put investment dollars as opposed to being a little bit loose with some of this funding. So we have strongly encouraged that Congress look to make the ReConnect program a permanent program. Right now it's still in pilot stage. I would say, based on what I have seen, it is a success. Let's make it permanent. I also think keeping the standards that we are seeing, that 100 over 100, rural Americans deserve the same access to higher speeds that people in urban America do. I hate the idea that people are so willing to build to a lower standard because they're rural Americans. And there's definitely some folks in the industry, particularly those in the cable part of the industry, who have really been advocating pretty vociferously to lower some of those standards. And to that I say, you know, let's not make rural Americans second-class citizens. So again, I think that USDA does a really nice job. They also vet the track record of those entities that come in for the funding. So they make sure that when they make an award, whether it's a grant or a loan grant, that provider who they're making that award to can actually do what they say they're going to do. And I think that verification is really important. So I'm wildly bullish about USDA.
Not long ago, we had Jim Matheson with the NRECA on the program, and one element of the co-ops is also stepping into providing broadband. But he suggested that the regulatory landscape in Washington was challenging for a not-for-profit co-op compared to other private enterprise. Well, you represent hundreds of independent telecoms. Is the regulatory landscape navigable for your group, or do you need some hurdles to be lowered that would allow you to be on a level playing field with those for profit?
It's a really interesting question, and I would say, you know, are there burdens that could be eased and we could move a lot faster? Absolutely. I think about streamlining. I think about permitting. I think about the fact that if you're building out west, you have to go through the Forest Service and BLM and, you know, all of these different hoops, the hoops and the barriers that railroads put up to building broadband, all of those things. There's ways to streamline that. I would say probably, you know, while I have all of, you know, the traditional telephone cooperatives who are nonprofits, having hundreds of community-based providers as well, you know, I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, my guys are probably a little bit more used to those regulatory hurdles because they've been in the communication space for so long. So they are not foreign to my companies. They understand the process. They know what it's like to work with the FCC. Are there challenges that we are seeing now as nonprofits or community-based providers, given that these large for-profits are very drawn to federal funding, kind of like moths to a flame, and that makes it hard to compete in some of these areas? Maybe. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see, because I will share that I am seeing for-profit large nationwide providers suddenly being interested in bringing service to rural communities that they walked away from in the past. Now, at the end of the day, my feeling is, you know, part of our mission is to ensure that all Americans have access to robust broadband service. If my guys aren't the ones in there providing it, I'd like to see those consumers get access to that service. But I don't find it a sheer coincidence that federal funding, you know, is bringing some of these large players out. And my only thought there is they need to comply with the same regulations that everybody else needs to comply with. And we need to make sure that there is a level playing field. And frankly, Jeff, it's going to take every tool in the toolkit. If we're really serious about every American having access to broadband, it's going to take partnerships. It's going to take people collaborating. It's going to take communities working with providers. It's going to take everybody coming to the table to get the job done.
So let's put a legal pad on the table with a Sharpie and make a list. What do you need from Washington?
Okay, so I need some good common sense rules and coordination as this money comes down. I need to make sure, to your earlier point, that folks are coordinating, that we are mapping, that in real time we are figuring out, you know, where the money is going. The other thing I need from Washington is I need a commitment, not just that, you know, this money is the shiny toy and we're going to build broadband. I need a continued commitment on universal service to ensure that where we do build broadband with all of this new money, that we are able to maintain that broadband and we are able to keep it affordable for rural Americans. Very important part of the mission of universal service. I'm going to need Washington to focus on that. I'm going to need them to streamline some of these regulatory barriers so we can get broadband built as quickly as we can get it built. I'm going to need supply chain challenges being dealt with. I'm going to need to make sure that the government steps in where necessary to make sure that it's not just the large corporations that get access to some of the software and the hardware and the fiber optics. I'm going to need to make sure that my guys have access to that equipment as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to need to make sure that rural America has the workforce to actually build these networks. So I'm going to need support from the government to basically say, what are those programs that will help us keep, you know, that rural talent in these rural communities so they can be the next leaders of these rural broadband operations?
So has all of the low-hanging fruit with the best profit potential been harvested by now? And what is the attitude of the company or the co-op or the independent that would come in and shoulder the task of the capital investment to provide service for those who are in need?
Yeah, you are spot on. It's a game of economics. And honestly, if you haven't been built to yet, there's a reason. And the reason is that you're just in a really high cost area, really low density area, and there's not a lot of other customers to pick up along the way. So it is a game of economics. And I think that is where I look at it and I say, you know, the ability to do a lot of this with grants, the ability to do things like, for example, one of the things that is an oxymoron that we get overlooked a lot is that due to a tax provision that went in 2017, federal grants get taxed. So even, you know, a grant will not go as far as we need it to go in some of these underserved areas. So I think you're going to need people to think creatively. I think local governments that serve some of these, you know, high-cost, underserved areas, local governments are going to have to get into play. And I would say in those areas, you know, reach out to a local provider, reach out to an independent broadband provider, you know, figure out a way to, you know, come together. I think we're going to have to create some economies of scale in some of these really hard areas. And I think it is the ripe opportunity for people to think a little bit out of the box and be problem solvers and to collaborate with maybe an entity that you might not have thought about working with before. Maybe it's your local schools. Maybe it's your local libraries. But I think we're going to have to do what rural America does best, and that is come together and problem solve. And I am absolutely convinced that those unserved areas are up to the task.
So let's talk about the cause of rural broadband. Define or describe the relationship between broadband and education, broadband and healthcare, broadband and jobs, and broadband and food security.
Right, and then precision ag and efficiency, and the list goes on and on and on and on. I love nothing more than having people actually get the light bulb that goes off when they see what you can do with technology and how it actually improves lives. And, you know, all of those things you listed, Jeff, are so on my list. The one that I am particularly focused on that I think is just so significant for rural Americans is healthcare. And, you know, the applications that we have seen, and we saw it during COVID, right? People couldn't go to the doctor. Doctor's offices were closed. The ability, we run a healthcare benefit plan. We have a Teladoc program. Watching the number of rural Americans that utilize Teladoc so they could sit in their living room and get access to medical care using broadband connectivity is so significant. Now I think about the fact that, you know, rural Americans, you know, veterans, we do a lot of work putting VA healthcare in local community centers because we're asking our vets to travel 3-4 hours to the state VA office. What if they could get that care in, you know, a local library in a private space? You know, the ability to utilize telemedicine in really creative ways. We just ran our Smart Rural Community Live conference, and I had somebody there who was showing off some diagnostic materials for those with heart conditions and diabetes, and the ability to monitor on a daily, on an hourly basis, gathering that data using that broadband connectivity in the home to a healthcare facility that is a specialist in some of these diseases, and the ability to manage it without having to drive to the big city. Just so significant in terms of the things that we can do using technology. And I think I love getting people to share their stories. I literally had a county judge who shared how he is using broadband connectivity to actually monitor drug abuse cases that come before him. And his success rate in terms of not having these repeat offenders come back before him was significant. It was well over 50% the national average because the ability to monitor, use that technology, and that doesn't even touch what we can do in terms of jobs, seeking jobs, doing your jobs from home. My companies now have IT staff that are spread all over the country because you know what? You don't necessarily need your IT guy in the office. You can actually work remotely. So the ability for rural America to tap talent from all over the country because we figured out how to do some of these virtual jobs, that's really exciting. We can compete with Silicon Valley. So I tend to think the possibilities are endless, and it's one of the reasons we talk a lot about building smart rural communities, using that broadband to power what these communities can do to set themselves up.
Surely there is this phrase of letting the fox guard the hen house, and that we bring broadband to all of these areas of the rural part of the country. What about cybersecurity?
Oof. So if there is one thing that keeps me up at night, it is absolutely cybersecurity. It is the protection of these networks. It's protecting customer data, and it's protecting the networks that my companies manage. Frankly, it's the security of the network of my own operation. We think about it a lot. One of the things that I do think is going to be interesting with all of this federal funding is there will definitely be a cybersecurity component to it. Entities who go in and get this funding will have to show that they have a cybersecurity plan, that they are aware, that they have a fiduciary responsibility to ensure that any data that they have is secured. But holy cow, have these hackers gotten sophisticated, and you know, the number of attempts to come into my own network from Russia and China at 3 a.m. is pretty impressive. And I can tell you I probably have unpaid invoices because I don't click anything anymore. But cybersecurity is going to be extremely important, and I think we all have a responsibility to be vigilant to protect these networks.
Well, Shirley Bloomfield, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. And I'll share with this program, you've got a good audience inside the Beltway. You've got a good audience of influencers on the Hill and even legislators. And then you have a good section of agriculture leaders across the country that tune in regularly. So the opportunity in closing today is knowing that audience. What message do you share with regard to broadband, rural broadband, and the independent telecoms that you represent?
I so appreciate that. So I would share that this is a time for all of us, those who care about rural America, those who care about the future of rural America, and those who see actually potential for a rural renaissance. It is our time to keep our foot on the gas. It is a time to make sure that this focus remains on rural communities and what technology and what broadband can bring to them in every single sector that we are talking about, and how that is such an important component for the rest of the country. If rural America is healthy and doing well, that means the rest of the country thrives. And so I would just say, we've got this moment in time. Let's take advantage of it. Let's find ways to collaborate, find ways to compare notes, and let's find some ways to work together.
Our thanks to Shirley Bloomfield, CEO of NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.